Hello and welcome. It wasn't even a year ago, and it's still a chilling memory. The winter of 2023-24 saw a series of fierce storms that reshaped the Maine landscape. The storms battered landmarks and waterfront communities. Most of us hunkered inside, did not venture out to face the storm's fury and impact. The series of winter storms began in December. Unprecedented rains flooded western and central Maine with sustained winds of 35 to 40 miles per hour, gusting well beyond that, bringing additional damage to the state. Shortly after the new year, on January 10th, the destruction shifted to the coast, with record high tides, heavy rain, and severe winds hitting all at once. Wharfs were demolished, fishing shacks were battered and dragged out to sea, boats were destroyed, rivers were swollen, and the main streets of many villages and towns were 2 to 3 feet underwater. January 13th, only 3 days after the previous storm, the ocean again erupted with swelling tides well above normal. Few communities on the Maine coast were spared. And in early March, yet another dangerous storm arrived. Again, it coincided with abnormally high tides. On Harpswell's Bailey Island, the working waterfront wound up submerged by the pounding surf. Even homes and pathways sitting well above the water's edge were lashed by the spray of breaking waves. Maine's working waterfront was devastated by the winter storms of 2023-24. Governor Janet Mills declared in the aftermath, "Working waterfronts are a cornerstone of our coastal communities and our economy. And last winter's devastating storms demonstrated just how vulnerable they are to extreme weather and climate change." The state of Maine dedicated funds for rebuilding 68 of the hardest hit coastal communities. Mills went on to say that working waterfronts must be protected for Maine today and for generations to come. My guest today is Sam Belknap. Sam is the current director of Maine Island Institute Center for Marine Economy, overseeing the work on several fronts, including protecting and sustaining Maine's working waterfronts. I was particularly interested in hearing how Sam felt that climate change was affecting Maine. Sam, welcome to the podcast. Thanks so much for spending time with us today.
Yeah, thanks, Mark, and thrilled to be joining you today.
Sam, you're the current director of the Maine Island Institute's Center for Marine Economy, a job title that probably didn't even exist when you were growing up. But before we get into your work today, I'd love to explore some of the early experiences in your life that gave you your love of the sea, and especially Maine's working waterfront. So let's roll back the clock for a minute, Sam. How did you get to where you are today? What did that path look like?
I don't know if we have enough time on the podcast to cover that, Mark, but okay. I appreciate
it. Okay, the Cliff Notes version.
Let's do the Cliff Notes version. So I grew up in the coast of Maine. I grew up in Damariscotta, where I've been able to return to in recent years.
Right.
But I grew up on both sides of the Pemaquid Peninsula. I had two working parents, so I spent a lot of my time with my grandparents. They had a home on the Damariscotta River. So I got to spend time there looking out on oyster aquaculture, the emerging sector there in the early 80s and early 90s. And on the other side of the peninsula, my grandfather, while he had to be convinced to purchase it back in the 50s, was lucky enough to purchase a working waterfront, a lobstering wharf in Round Pond, one of the villages of Bristol. Uh-huh. And I spent a lot of time on that side of the peninsula lobstering with my grandfather. So surrounded by salt and brackish water, I have oysters and lobsters in my blood. And
that's great.
I think that's probably one of the things that made me want to do what so many kids want to do in middle and grammar school, to become a marine biologist.
Uh-huh.
And for the longest time, I was convinced I was going to be a marine biologist to study this amazing thing that was our blue planet in whatever form I chose. But it was actually a fishing trip an annual fishing trip that my father and I would take to Mattagammon. It's a lake at the north entrance of Baxter State Park. And we would go there every fall. And one fall, the weather was unfortunately not conducive to fishing. It was a bit windy and a bit rainy for a while. And I had the opportunity to sit down and for 2 days read every single issue of National Geographic that existed in this fishing camp. And one of the things that I discovered was that there was this field called anthropology that studied humans over time. I remember distinctly reading about early human evolution in one of these magazines, and it sparked in me this fascination with how humans have dealt with our changing Earth over the last several million years, and how I was experiencing some of that in the coast of Maine. Mm-hmm. I remember around the same time, it was during the sea urchin boom, the sea urchin fishing boom on the coast of Maine. And I was seeing dozens of truckloads of urchins go across our wharf on a daily basis until one day a switch flipped and there was no more urchin fishing. It was a boom and bust fishery. And seeing that triggered in me this thinking around like, well, if humans have been interacting and changing with and alongside our Earth's climate for the past million years, like maybe they're doing that on a shorter time scale. And it really changed the way I thought about the ocean as not just a thing to be studied, but a thing that was intricately connected to human society and community. And that really changed the kind of course of my life, really.
That was the moment. I mean, that was the real moment
when I realized, well, that was one of the moments.
That was the moment
when I realized this was a thing that I could do and be engaged with like when I grew up. But I guess the real pivotal moment for me that allowed me to be where I am and caused me to really change the course of my then academic study to become more practically focused on solutions was the summer of 2012. I had been running my family's lobster wharf for a handful of years and was sitting in our little shop. We processed lobster, we processed crab, we bought and sold crab from a handful of fishermen in Round Pond. And 2012 happened to be an anomalously warm winter and spring in the Gulf of Maine. It actually mirrored conditions that some climate models predict for 2050 to 2075 with ocean warming.
Really? Wow. So that really changed the way the lobster fisheries worked, right?
Changed the way it functioned a little bit. The lobsters came in from offshore to molt earlier, prior to the opening of the Canadian processing plants and prior to the emergence of our seasonal tourist industry. So there was a flood of lobsters onto the market. As a result, this caused a price collapse. And I had a front row seat of watching this. And there was a day when I sat and I saw fishermen coming in and losing money, catching more lobsters than that they've ever caught before. Mm-hmm. And hearing folks on the radio say things like, I guess we'll need to make up for the price with more volume. And anyone that has a sense of kind of economic theory knows that when the price is low and you catch more and there's no demand, that's not a good solution to increasing price. And
it was really
that moment that changed me from focused on big, broad scale issues to really Maine based issues. And how can I take my passion for climate science, for human culture, and really turn it and focus it on the place that helped make me who I am today, the coast mm-hmm. of Maine.
Right. So this summer of 2012 with its weather anomaly really got you on the path to having a greater understanding and appreciation for climate science. Did that then influence your course of study?
In college, I can actually remember, I had the privilege of taking a class called Weather. And Weather talked by Professor Kirk Mosh at the University of Maine as part of their Climate Change Institute. And this one course around weather set the stage for my passion around climate science because it touched on not just what the drivers of weather are, but how weather plays a role and is influenced by long-term climatic changes in Earth. And it was that one course that created an entry point for me into this world of climate science. Mm-hmm.
When we talk about climate-related issues, I mean, you can't help but think about the communities that you work with day in and day out. How are they coping with these issues?
It's a story of both hope and challenge. Growing up on the coast of Maine and being a resident of the coast of Maine, we know the industrious nature of the people in these communities. I would best characterize the current state of Maine's working waterfronts as that of a heavyweight boxer in round 8 of a 10-round match. It's taken some pretty significant body blows this year in particular, but it's still standing and still standing strong.
Right.
The past winter's storms really did a number on a lot of wharves. And the current rebuild is in progress, even in the middle of this fishing season.
So would you say that's certainly maybe the top challenge facing the waterfront and those who work on the waterfront, work to preserve the health of the waterfront? Maybe that's, I was going to ask you what the biggest challenges were, but that's certainly one that's probably, you know, right smack in the middle of the radar, right?
Yeah, it's definitely part of it. I think the biggest challenge overall is definitely climate change. In prior years, conversion of property to non-working waterfront uses was the biggest challenge. But really these days, it's all things climate change. And it's really not just the storms and sea level rise, things that you think about as the immediate concerns and impacts on working waterfronts.
Right.
But the secondary impacts as well. When you start to talk about warming waters, changing the distribution of species like copepods, herring, lobster, and right whales, that puts a secondary set of pressures on these working waterfronts, in addition to flooding and storm surge.
Mm-hmm. Now, is it true that I had read that literally Maine's coastline is about 3,500 or so miles, and only 20 miles of that are devoted to what we'd call the working waterfront?
Yeah, almost two decades ago, the Institute initiated a report entitled The Last 20 Miles that showed that there was only 20 miles of waterfront access for working waterfront purposes left on the coast. So that point is true. The challenge is that's a 20-year-old report almost, and no inventory has been done in that intervening time. So it's really hard to say, are we still at 20 miles? I'm skeptical that we've increased our working waterfront access, but there is no hard and fast number that we know of right now. We have the pleasure of working as part of the Working Waterfront Coalition here in Maine, and there's a lot of folks thinking through how we redo this inventory, including folks at the state and the Department of Marine Resources and Maine Coastal Programs. Because without this baseline data of what we have left, it's really hard to know what we need to preserve or what the scale of investment is really going to be to make these working waterfronts prepared. So unfortunately, we don't know if it's 20 miles, 15 miles, or 10 miles. But hopefully, with the good work of partners, we're going to figure that out soon.
So when folks hear the term working waterfront, they probably jump to, oh, yeah, that's where folks, you know, who go out and fish commercially, that's where they, but it's more than that, yeah, the definition?
Absolutely, Mark. I think everyone has that kind of quintessential lobster wharf in their mind when they think of working waterfront.
Right.
But it is also the municipal boat landing where folks that aren't privileged enough to own their own piece of property on the water can access the water. Mm-hmm. It is oftentimes clam paths or through people's property, dirt paths that lead down to clam flats that have been used for generations that allow the clamming industry to access those mud flats that are critical for its success. Mm-hmm. So it can take many forms. It's also the numerous boat yards and boat shops that dot Maine's coast that support that on the water activity.
Right. I think most of us take for granted things like access to boat yards, public landings, places to launch our boats, kayaks or windsurfers. The thought of those access points could be in danger or of disappearing, not to mention fishing piers and commercial wharves. I mean, that's unthinkable, isn't it? So your team at the Island Institute is there to make sure as much as anyone can that doesn't happen, correct? Is that an accurate way to describe your current mission and goals?
Yeah, so we're a 40-year-old community development organization. We were originally formed to support the year-round unbridged islands, but we very quickly recognized that strong islands require a strong coast to be connected with. So we've mm-hmm. expanded to support all 152 coastal communities across Maine. And our mission is to boldly navigate climate and economic change with island and coastal communities to expand opportunities and deliver solutions.
Mm-hmm. And thereby keeping the waterfront viable.
We have our Center for Climate and Community, where we focus a lot on municipal level climate adaptation and mitigation. So adapting to sea level rise at the community level, talking about community scale, clean energy investments and projects and things like that. And I have the privilege of leading our Center for the Marine Economy, which focuses on what has been the linchpin of Maine's coastal economy for generations, if not centuries, is the diverse industry that is Maine's marine economy.
Mm-hmm.
And within our center, we focus on resilient working waterfronts, the topic we're here discussing today. But that's also closely connected to all of our other areas of work that include shellfish and seaweed aquaculture, the future of lobster, and our work on marine decarbonization, bringing clean energy and environmentally friendly solutions to the marine sector and to the working waterfront.
Mm-hmm. So your current work, you're director of Center for Marine Economy. What does that look like day to day?
Well, I'm thrilled to say it's actually a healthy mix of management. I oversee an incredible team of six individuals, many of whom have deep connections to various aspects of Maine's marine economy. But it's balanced nicely with boots on the dock and boots on the deck opportunities, where I'm able to actually be out meeting with community members, helping to identify and bring resources to lobstering co-ops, fishing businesses, aquaculture businesses. Many folks in these communities are wearing multiple hats, town managers that are also on the fire department, that are also local business leaders. And we often lack in many of these small communities access to the really robust support that is required to tackle things like planning for and addressing climate change. So we see pockets of businesses starting to do the right thing, working waterfronts, raising their wharves on their own.
Now that's got to be encouraging.
But we really started to see the state lean in and provide a lot of support through the Governor's Office of Policy Innovation in the Future to provide broad-scale planning support for these communities to help think through what the science means for them and their communities and to help access the planning resources so they can be prepared for when federal funds start to flow like they did to support the storm damage of last year.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if you or your listeners know, but the first round of Maine's Climate Action Plan, Maine Won't Wait, was actually an award-winning plan at the national level because of the thoroughness and thoughtfulness that the state has led in partnership with communities and the people of Maine in thinking through what climate change means for the coast and how to best address it.
It'd be great if you could share an example of just how that partnership works, especially in light of the 2023-24 storms that were so destructive to the coastline. I think we all remember how long it took for the waters to recede and for folks to get back to work.
Yeah, so I'll talk a bit about one aspect of our resilient working waterfront work. We were able to, thanks to our members and our generous supporters, spin up a fund that was able to provide grant funds to working waterfronts damaged by the storm in the immediate aftermath so they could start to rebuild. As part of this process, we worked closely with state agencies to raise awareness of the storm damage and the needs of businesses, as well as to create entry points for all of the resources that were then starting to flow.
Mm-hmm.
As an outgrowth of this, the state of Maine, thanks to an allocation of funds by the governor and working closely with the Maine Department of Marine Resources and the Maine Department of Transportation, they were able to invest roughly $25 million into the state's adaptation fund.
Mm-hmm.
But this is only one drop in the bucket of what needs to be done. In recent weeks, we just received notice that the state received $69 million to support a variety of climate adaptation measures, including continued support for the working waterfront in the form of several main Sea Grant positions to provide technical assistance and an additional $8 million to go into the state's adaptation fund.
Well, that, of course, sounds like a lot of money, but we all know the cost of rebuilding. Plus, you have to prepare for the future, and the climate clock is ticking. In terms of state and federal relief programs, are you sometimes frustrated that things aren't moving fast enough?
I think in general, when you look at both either the state or regulatory system, they are slow-moving beasts by nature. But I think we're starting to see an increased flexibility and focus and adaptability of a lot of these agencies. I think the storm response that the state initiated was a prime example of being able to move quickly. I mean, in less than a year, they were able to implement a major grant-making program to support numerous wharves. I do think that there is a time lag between the immediate needs and the ability to pull any type of state and federal policy lever.
Yeah.
So we were thrilled to see Senator King put forth a working waterfront tax bill in the recent weeks and look forward to supporting the implementation of that. Without partners, there is no work for us. And without partners, there are no policy needs for us as an individual organization. We are responsive to and respectful of the needs and challenges of coastal communities.
I mean, it all begins and ends with the communities. One of the things I wanted to ask you was that are there, at the state level or federal level for Maine, are there some real champions for the waterfront? You know, folks that are definitely, this is a priority for them.
We are lucky enough to have an amazing federal delegation that really recognizes the value of and the need for support for Maine's working waterfront. Mm-hmm. Representative Shelley Pingree has long championed specific bills around working waterfronts and continues to do so today. Senator King and Senator Collins are both champions of both our kind of historic and culturally important lobster fishery, as well as the working waterfronts mm-hmm. that allow it to exist. So we are lucky enough to have federal champions. But more importantly, because so many of these solutions are based at the state and local level, mm-hmm. we have state level champions, folks that are engaged in our working waterfront coalition. We're able to engage deeply and fundamentally influence the latest round of Maine's climate action plan. In addition to the state and the local decision makers, the town managers that are advocating for what their community needs in towns like Stonington, Vinyl Haven, the two largest fishing ports on the coast of Maine. Mm-hmm. And in numerous other number of towns to mention in our brief time today, but those local champions are really the ones that are able to elevate their community's voice into these state and federal processes.
I mean, it's always a delicate balance, yeah. The policy initiatives against the needs of folks who are in the communities, you know, day to day making a living and depending on the sea and that working waterfront for their livelihood.
It is a tough one. Maine is a big coast. Our diversity of communities have a diversity of challenges and a diversity of needs. Part of our work and part of where we've seen significant success within our organization and at the state level are finding those commonalities where there is strong support across the coast for mm-hmm. specific initiatives.
Right.
Maine's Working Waterfront is one prime example of that. Whether it is a clam path or whether it is a traditional working waterfront, regardless of where you are in the coast, support for those to be adaptable, flexible, and prepared for the future are something that everyone can get behind.
Mm-hmm. What, in your mind, do you see happening to the working waterfront communities of Maine if we don't pay attention to some of these big issues confronting the industry? Kind of a loaded question, but...
But it's a good one. I think it is something that keeps me up at night. Because when you start to layer on all of the various stressors, at its core, the biggest threat is still climate change, but it's what climate change causes. And this is back to the foundational issue that brought our organization into the waterfront space two decades ago. And that's conversion.
Conversion. That means, of course, converting working waterfront lands to hotels, condos, parking garages, restaurants, office buildings, and so on.
Once these properties are sold along Maine's coast for non-working waterfront uses, they are not able to be recovered. This is a finite resource. A colleague and board member of ours calls it the most critically endangered asset that Maine has.
Right, understandably.
So as we continue to see climate change stressors, fishing regulation stressors, the aging of our fleet and the graying of our fleet, and folks looking to recoup some of the investment that they made into these properties by selling them for other uses, we're starting to see the conversion of property at a more rapid rate. This started in the pandemic and continues to this day.
Yeah.
In a way that we haven't seen since the early 2000s. Mm. And my biggest fear is that this conversion will continue as folks are seeing uncertainty around their future in the fishery and on the water, mm-hmm. whether that's from climate change, whether it's from federal regulations to protect North Atlantic right whales, or whether it's from whatever factor, factor of the day you choose to be focused on. That uncertainty is going to motivate folks to exit the fishery and sell property that they may not have sold otherwise.
Right.
So stress, climate change, and the conversion of this property. My biggest fear is that we are sitting here in a year or two's time and talking about the last 10 miles, the last 5 miles. Mm. And it's that consolidation that's really going to limit communities' ability to adapt their marine economy to the future. Because without these working waterfronts, there is no economic connection to the ocean, whether that's aquaculture, whether that's wild harvest fishing, or whether it's some other ocean use. These working waterfronts play that critical role that connect our broader economy to the ocean.
No, that's a great point. And you touch on something that before we wrap up, I did want to get you to expand a little bit more, and that's adaptation. We know that, I mean, nobody likes to think about a way of life disappearing. Like, nobody likes to think about lobsters disappearing, but nobody likes to think, but then years ago, they didn't want to think about cod disappearing or, you know, shrimp disappearing in the Gulf of Maine. But there is an inevitability about this. And I know that a good deal of your work is about preparing for that future. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. The one constant that's existed in our maritime culture and maritime economy in Maine's history has been change. If you look at whether it was codfish or schooners shipping lumber across the world, or whether it was lobstering and the birth of that as an industry over the last 125 years, things have changed. Things have always changed around a center of diversity, though. If you look back to early generations and my grandfather's generation and earlier, there was no such thing as a lobsterman. There was a fisherman that was engaged in innumerable activities throughout the year, whether it was lobstering in the summer, scalloping and shrimping in the winter, utilizing carpentry skills developed around boat building to do various work throughout the year. There was always a cadence and a diversity of activities going on. It's kind of the original gig economy, to use a term of today.
Yeah.
What we've lost in our maritime sector is that diversity. And that's really what a lot of our work is focused on, is returning through other avenues to a level of diversity that makes it so disruptions to any one aspect of it, disruptions to the lobster fishery, aren't overly detrimental. We've seen great success in aquaculture in serving a part of this niche. And I think one of my favorite statistics is that most of the kelp grown in the United States is grown by Maine lobstermen. Mm. And that's a huge acknowledgement of both the willingness to take risks and the willingness to embrace new opportunities. So it's really a mutual relationship between the people that rely on these working waterfronts and how they are making a living and able to make a living, and how these working waterfronts evolve over the next decades.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I can't help but think that whatever we can do to raise awareness of Maine's working waterfront. It's such a vital part of not only Maine's economy, but when you look around the world, the waterfront is really unique. The culture is unique. The people are unique. And I know that you, Sam, and your team at Maine's Island Institute are doing everything you can each day of the week to ensure that Maine's working waterfront remains not only healthy, but vibrant long into the future. So I'm going to ask you a last question, which I love to ask everybody, and that's if you have a favorite tale of the sea, an anecdote, a book, a story, a poem, a song, something inspired by the sea that you come back to time and again.
I absolutely do, Mark. And you'll get a chuckle out of this because you recently did a podcast on it. It is Moby Dick.
Oh, great. Great.
Moby Dick and Herman Melville's ability to meld a fundamental story of humanity with a deep scientific treatise on the whale.
Yeah,
it's something that tugs on my soul and stimulates my mind in equal parts, which is something I think every good novel should do. And I had the pleasure of reading it first when I was 12 years old, and returned to it every few years to read it again. And I'm always discovering new nuances and new lessons contained in that novel.
That's great. Yeah, it's fascinating. It's endlessly fascinating. Listen, Sam, I want to thank you so much. You've been wonderfully generous of your time. We covered a lot of ground, but I think it's really important that people, if they don't have an understanding of what the waterfront means to not only Maine, but to communities around the world, it's really important that they do. So thank you so much again.
Mark, thank you for having me, and thank you for helping raise awareness around Maine's working waterfront and the critical role that it plays, as well as the challenges that it's facing.
That ends this episode of Tales of the Sea. As always, if you enjoyed this episode, please tell a friend or two. My thanks to Sam Belknap of Maine's Island Institute for joining me today, sharing his personal story and experience. Yeah, I want to say that we've just barely scratched the surface of all the great work that goes on at the Island Institute. So for those of you who would like more information or just curious about the work of the Institute, be sure to go to islandinstitute.org. And remember that you can find Tales of the Sea wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. I'm Mark Winkworth. Thanks for listening.